Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 397, working close to 400, of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host, as usual. Today, my guest is John Mahoney. John is the founder of the law offices of John Mahoney, and they focus exclusively on federal employment law, which is a subject area near and dear to my heart, being from the Washington, D.C. area, although, as John quite clearly points out, federal employment law is not only all over the country, but indeed around the world, with federal employees being stationed all around the world. And it's a very interesting discussion with him about his virtual practice in the federal employment law space and how he was influenced by his father's experience in the industrial area of Worcester, Massachusetts. Again, something very dear to me as a result of personal friends from the Worcester area. So it's an interesting conversation that he and I have, maybe a little bit more in the substantive area of the law that we normally do on this program. But I hope you enjoy listening to John and learning a little bit about how he built a practice in the federal employment law space. So without any further delay, here is John Mahoney. John Mahoney, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Neil.
Well, it's a thrill to have you with us today, John. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. John Patrick Mahoney, originally from Worcester, Mass., the son of a steelworker union activist from the 50s and 60s. Got in the business of following him and learning about labor law and getting interested in the labor movement and the civil rights movement of the 60s. He had volunteered for John Kennedy and his campaign in 1959, 1960. So I just was a disciple of my dad and learned about the labor movement and how important employment law rights are for people across the world. My dad had lost his job when his factory closed down in the mid-80s at the age of 55 and had a very difficult time finding other employment. And ultimately, you know, he unfortunately passed away from his depression and his alcoholism that resulted from his unemployment. So I understand firsthand, you know, how important employment is to people and families and, you know, society in general. So I went to law school at Catholic University in D.C., and I've been practicing now officially as of 2 days from now, 30 years, representing exclusively federal government employees, civil servants, public servants, and employment law matters and national security cases throughout the world.
Well, going back to your dad's time and his involvement in the labor movement, kind of the golden era, a little bit of progressive changes in the labor field, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. He was. He used to tell me story. He was born in 1932.
Sure.
So he lived through the World War II, and he served in the U.S. Army during the Korean War era, and he and my mom, who was born in 1934, would tell me stories about FDR and the New Deal and how it saved his family and countless other families from the poverty of the Great Depression and gave them hope and gave them an opportunity to have meaningful employment. And my dad was a machinist and you know, was active in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is my hometown. Labor and employment law issues as a factory worker there, and got very active in the machinist union, and you know, through the 60s and the with JFK and RFK, LBJ, and the civil rights movement and everything else. And, you know, lived a very good life until, you know, 1988 or so, when he passed away from, unfortunately, alcoholism.
Yeah.
After losing his job when he turned 50. He was 55 in 88. So he lost his job when he was age 50 and ended up taking a job as a janitor in my high school when I went to high school there. So that was quite, you know, depressing for him. And sadly, he never recovered.
Yeah. I think, you know, back to those times, you know, large part for me is history, but I'm old too. So some of it is actual firsthand knowledge. But the, you know, the labor movement and the role of unions and to improving the quality of life for folks really in the New England area and down south as well, was really very significant. And I think is lost on our society a little bit today. We take it for granted and we don't recognize all that went into making the progress that, you know, like I said, I think we take for granted these days.
Sure.
Now we think of labor law as being something to just, you know, protect your rights in the workplace from getting, you know, fired unceremoniously. And certainly that's part of it. But labor law has a rich history.
Sure. You know, I'm an Irish Catholic kid from Worcester, Massachusetts. So my great-great-grandfather emigrated to the U.S. in, you know, when he was 20 in 1855. And he served in the Union Army in the Civil War. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. So served in the Union Army in the Civil War, had one child in 1865 after when the war ended, and then died from his wounds in 1867. I would not be here if it weren't for the fact that he had one son and who is my great grandfather. And from that, you know, my father was born and my grandfather was born. And he was one of six and my father was one of 12. I have about 58 first cousins, most of whom still live in Worcester, Mass. And all of them are blue collar. I was the first person in my family to attend college and obviously law school as well. So, you know, the labor movement, I remember walking picket lines when I was a kid, you know, 7 days holding a sign. And, you know, we went from unlimited, required, basically almost slavery, master-servant employment relationships in the 1800s, where people were forced to work unlimited hours for very little pay under unsafe conditions, including children, to, you know, the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act and, you know, putting a cap 40-hour work weeks, overtime for time spent above that, 5-day work weeks. You know, we can thank the unions for the weekends, frankly, because without them, there wouldn't be any. And so child labor laws and obviously the protections that came from the New Deal that ultimately resulted in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Civil Rights Movement of the 60s and the various statutes that have come into play since then, the Age Discrimination Employment Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and these statutes, which are, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years old now, people do tend to take for granted the struggle. You know, people die to create these labor laws, including Dr. Martin Luther King, who died.
They weren't simply invented, you know, in the labor law classroom at the law schools around. You know,
exactly. They came about as a result of blood, sweat, and tears.
For sure. You know, I have a very good friend whose family's from Worcester. So I've spent a little bit of time up there, and you cannot be around that city, and there's others like it, but Worcester in particular, you can't be around that city without feeling the history of the labor movement.
For sure. Steel was there.
All those lovely old factory buildings that are now being renovated and turned into lots of, you know, special types of things have that almost that ghostly image or connection back to that era.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I go there pretty regularly. In fact, I'm going up there this weekend.
Yeah.
And yeah, I, you know, I.
And I have a bit of a
38, so I know.
And I have a personal connection myself to the whole process, because my first big boy job, you know, where I actually earned a salary, was in a union shop. And, you know, it was Communication Workers of America, and I worked at the Goddard Space Flight Center. So, you know, think of something like a NASA facility having a labor force that in part was benefiting from collective bargaining and union representation. So my first job was in a union environment. And I remember my first employee was a unionized secretary, and she taught me all there was that I needed to know about, you know, work relationships and how to manage those, because, you know, she was very confident in knowing what was her rights and what she had to do. And so it was a great experience for me. I told many folks over the course of time how important that was for my personal education and the development in the workplace. So
sure.
Now,
in my past,
much about substantive legal issues, principally because I'm not smart enough to carry that conversation. But I'm curious how your journey transpired once you graduated from my alma mater, the Catholic University of America, Columbus School of Law. Did you go straight into a practice? Or did you work for the government then? Or what was your pathway?
Sure. So when I went to college at Assumption College in Worcester.
Yep.
And I had not even thought about being a lawyer. My original major was computer science, and then I switched to business management, and then I added a business law class, which led to a constitutional law class in the politics department, and a politics minor and a philosophy minor. So I transitioned from being a, you know, computer scientist student through business management, through, politics and constitutional law. And it's interesting that now I, you know, practice constitutional law and federal employment law online on my computer. So all of these interests that I had no connection or no plan necessarily have all sort of come together nicely in the virtual law firm that I've run for the last 10 years. And it's pretty exciting. And so when I was in law school, I had a very good labor law professor in my second and third year, Roger Hartley. And
I remember Brett.
I'm a Hartley disciple for sure.
Yeah, he was there when I was there.
And he got me, you know, I was a moot court associate, and he told me that I should, you know, participate in the Wagner Cup, which is the labor law moot court competition. And so I did. I think that was my second year. And he was on my first panel as the chief judge, and George Murphy from the Food and Commercial Workers Union was on the panel as well. And so I'm basically a second year law student and arguing a labor law case for the very first time, standing up in a moot court room and arguing labor law to these two experts in the field. And I was nervous. I was scared to death. And at the end of the moot court session, both Roger and Mr. Murphy said, "Oh, that was the best argument I've ever heard." And I was shocked. I was like, "Really? Like, yeah, where are you going to go to work after you get out of here?" I'm like, "I don't know. I haven't, you know, I'm like just a rising 2L. And, well, you know, they're going to be lucky to get you wherever you are. So I appreciated that compliment from both of them. And I really became very, you know, when I say I'm a Hartley disciple, I became, you know, very active and interested in labor law under his tutelage. So I owe him a lot for my career. In the summer of my first year, after my first year, I interned for the DC government's labor relations office. I can't remember the name necessarily now. It's a long time ago. And labor relations and collective bargaining agency. that would represent the government, the DC government in labor relations work. And then I interned or clerked my third year for a labor arbitrator, Roger Kaplan, as part of one of Hartley's labor law classes. And so that he was doing federal sector labor arbitration. So I got to shadow him and write, you know, draft arbitration awards for him over the last semester of my law school life. And I graduated in 93. And during that time frame, the job market wasn't great. And I happened to, you know, find a law clerk job at a small AV rated federal employment law firm that practiced union side, you know, employee side work. So I kind of fell into the business as a summer law clerk. And I stayed there, you know, for 10 years, basically. Went from being a law clerk to, you know, arguing and winning appeals before the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which is the second highest court in the United States. I got to write a petition for writ of certiorari in a Supreme Court case that involved federal employment and the applicability of the Privacy Act to federal employment to protect federal employees. And it was the first case to award a federal employee compensatory damages for intentional violations of her Privacy Act rights. And it ended up going to the Supreme Court and ended up with the Smithsonian Institution, which was the agency being treated or being added to the definition of agency under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 for the federal sectors, you know, with 2000E-16. So it was the first time they added Smithsonian and definition of agency. So I had some pretty big cases. I had a very big class action on behalf of retired park police officers in the U.S. District Court in D.C. when I was, you know, a mid, maybe third year, fourth year associate. Got to write and argue and win a motion for a summary judgment before Judge Stanley Sporkin in the U.S. District Court. That award, it was a multi-million-dollar award for these retired park police. And so, you know, every year that the active park police got a raise, the retirees would get the same raise to their annuity. So it was a pretty big deal.
Eventually, you ended up going into private practice. How did that come about?
Yep. So I went, finished that first job and applied for another senior associate job at a second law firm, which was more of a management side federal employment law firm. And I worked as a senior associate there from 2000 to 2003. Then I opened my own practice, Mahoney & Mahoney, in 2003. And did that until 2008. Bought out of that firm, went to live in Hawaii for a year to just chill, and came back. Joined another law firm to do federal employment law as a partner, and stayed there until 2014. And then I started my current firm. So now, you know, this April 4th, which is, you know, the anniversary of the establishment of my current firm, which is also the anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. That was not. It's certainly intentional. This April 4th will be our 10th year. So,
perfect.
You know, we've been representing federal government employees and labor and employment law matters, civil rights cases, national security appeals throughout the United States and around the world for 10 years.
Yeah. So you mentioned in passing that your practice is virtual. This current iteration of law firm of John Mahoney, Were you virtual from the start, or did the pandemic, you know, push you in that direction?
We were virtual from the start, from April 4th, 2014, okay. Which is well before the pandemic.
Yep.
So, you know, we've been awarded innovation and excellence awards for the way I've created this firm. This was an intentional hybrid virtual and brick and mortar law practice from day one. We have offices in the Reagan Building downtown, 1300 Pennsylvania Avenue in DC, Northwest. But to the extent we can, which is almost 100% now, we practice, you know, virtually from wherever we are in the world, because we represent federal employees all over the world. So we have a...
Well, that was going to be my point. It's a practice area, frankly, that lends itself, or perhaps even demands that you be able to do that, because as you said, you federal employees, again, are not just located here in the Washington, D.C. area. They're all around the country and indeed all around the world.
Yeah.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, Lexaclara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's 5 or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/TLE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I've been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor. You know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com.
And a lot of changes have occurred both before and after and since COVID. You know, most all of our pleadings are electronically filed. You know, most all of the courts, including the Supreme Court, have an electronic filer system now. So there's very little paper that is printed and mailed like it used to be in the old days, or even faxed like it used to be in the old days. Now everything is, you know, electronically filed in PDF format and can be filed from anywhere in the world. So, you know, we were kind of ahead of the curve in terms of developing the virtual law practice, but it's, you know, the way it's developed has tracked the way our society has changed and has become far more virtual and far more, you know, based on at-home work as opposed to in-office work, which is great for the environment. There's a lot less fumes from gasoline, automobiles, a lot less commuting.
Yep.
And so it's cleaner for the environment, and it's better for efficiency. You know, we can work whenever, wherever we want. You know, I've got partners in Switzerland. I've got partners in California. I've got partners in Alabama and New York City. So, yeah, you know, we are literally all over the world.
So, you know, starting, you know, from the get-go as being a virtual practice and being as geographically dispersed as you are, it put some pressure on you as the founder to have a vision of how you want growth to take place and how you want communications to support the operations of the practice. So what are some of the key features that you incorporated into the design of your law firm to allow you to function the way you do?
Sure. So what is very important, vital to our existence, is our remote desktop server. So we have a remote desktop server system whereby people have to sign in with their credentials. And once they're on the server, they have access to all of our client files, the contents thereof, every piece of paper, not that we get much paper anymore, but every piece of paper we get, we scan into our RDS and it's saved into the corresponding client's electronic client file. All of our time is kept on, you know, time slips, which is one of the software programs that we use. We share calendars for, you know, our appointments and obviously emails internally and externally. So we do a lot of work on Teams and Zoom to have attorney meetings and client meetings, frankly, and also advocacy meetings, because, you know, we do a lot of our advocacy now on Zoom or Teams, depending on the level of security of the particular agency involved. So everything is remote. We used to, you know, back in the day, I used to meet all my clients and potential clients in my office. I don't, you know, I think I've had two office meetings in the entire, you know, 2023.
Is that right? Yeah.
Everything else, you know, even the local people, I hardly ever see my clients anymore. You know, and back in the day, people would come to the office to have an initial consultation in person. And, you know, we would meet in the conference room and do work on cases together and et cetera, et cetera. Now, you know, I very rarely, it's the exception that I actually meet a client anymore in person. I had one SES level client who I went to her agency to advocate on her behalf. But that's like the only client in-person advocacy I've had the entire 2023. By phone and by Zoom.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of folks can relate to that, because particularly post-pandemic, you know, that's really the way of the world, and particularly the way things are going in the legal space. But it does present its own challenges in terms of team building, for instance, and creating a culture.
Yeah.
Creating a culture. You know, again, back in the day, a lot of team building and cultural development took place around the coffee pot or the water, you know, fountain. And it relied on face-to-face communications and interactions. And so trying to create that in a virtual world, and particularly one that's geographically dispersed, is always a challenge. Tell us a little bit about how you go about, you know, finding quality people to hire to start with and building them into a cohesive team.
Sure. So because we're, you know, almost virtually 100% virtual, we can, and because we represent federal government employees in federal litigation, federal statutory litigation, governed by quasi-judicial federal administrative agencies, we are not limited geographically to the states in which we are licensed to practice.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm licensed in Maryland and in D.C. And in fact, Friday is my 30th anniversary of being licensed in the state of Maryland. And so I'm excited about that. I can't believe I made it for 30 years. But
congratulations.
Thank you. And so we can attract and do attract potential attorney hires from all over the world. I've had, like I said, I have a partner now who lives in Switzerland. I have partners, you know, all over across the country. Mm-hmm. And it's great, because wherever the federal government is, our clients are. And so, you know, it is a challenge to team build, and it is a challenge to have open communication with my lawyers. You know, in the old days, we used to go to the office next door if we wanted to talk to our partner or go to a conference room down the hall. But now, you know, it's not as easy to do that. So now we have to, you know, book Zoom calls or book, you know, phone calls.
On the calendar, yeah.
Get on the calendar, you know, so it's not as fluid necessarily or as, you know, as easily accomplished without pre-planning. But you know, we certainly overcome those challenges, and the benefits of the virtual law practice for my lawyers and for me and for my clients, frankly, are great. Because, you know, the way I do business is my lawyers are all independent contractor 1099 attorneys, and I pay them 1/3 of their reasonable realized revenue at our rates are set by the Department of Justice under their Fitzpatrick's matrix, which used to be called the Laffey yep. matrix back in the day. Now it's the Fitzpatrick matrix. So our hourly rates are set by justice. All the federal agencies, you know, have to use them, and they're de facto considered reasonable because justice created them.
Sure.
And yeah. So, you know, so I pay my lawyers as independent contractors 1/3 of their reasonable realized revenue at their whatever their appropriate Fitzpatrick matrix hourly rate is to work remotely and for me and on our firm cases. And so, you know, I don't have a billable hour requirement like most firms. Lawyers can work as many hours or as few hours as they want from anywhere in the world. They don't have to get in their car and drive to the office or put on a suit most of the days. They can, you know, I practice law in my pajamas most of the time. And so, you know,
I have a dilemma coming up. I have a court hearing, and I haven't been in court in a long time, and I'm trying to figure out, do I really have to put socks on?
I know. See, I got all dressed up for you. I thought this was a video call, so I put
best I could, a real lawyer. Yeah.
Which was exciting because, you know, for 25 years, I wore a suit every day. Now it's like it's a pleasure to put on a suit, which, you know, 25, you know, on my 25th anniversary, I would have, you know, never worn another suit if I could get away with it. Now it's exciting to put on a suit, even though I didn't need to.
And tell me going forward, what's your vision in terms of growth and sustainability as a law firm? And are you happy where you're at now, or anticipate growing? If so, how do you go about setting those goals and achieving them?
Yeah, so I expect that we are entering a growth phase. The demand for our firm's legal services is increasing, ever increasing. And, you know, right now I've got 10 lawyers on staff. And so one of my philosophies in law practice, I sort of developed what I affectionately call the Mahoney method of federal employment litigation. But so my standard view on when I need to hire lawyers is dependent on when the current lawyers I have are reaching the maximum capacity that they're mm-hmm. able to handle. So my rule of thumb is when all of my lawyers are at about 30 cases each, that's when I need to hire another lawyer. And so I'm kind of at that point. You know, usually when we get to December every year, we kind of almost hit and sometimes, sometimes exceed our capacity as a law firm. And we are at that point now in December of 2023, as we typically are in December of each year. So I usually end up hiring new lawyers starting in January. I'm in the process of, you know, going through the hiring process now. And so my philosophy going forward really is, rather than simply, as I have done in past years, keeping the case numbers limited to that capacity, which is about 120 cases per year, I'm going to sort of change my approach and really just, you know, let the floodgates continue to be open and then just hire more and more lawyers to meet that demand. I mean, the main thing in our practice, which is why we're so successful, is that we don't do things until the market demands that they be done. Overhead, in my view, overhead kills law firms, kills small law firms. So, you know, our office yeah. space is shared office space. It's not, you know, leased office space that is hard to get out of. The only reason I even have it is because the government requires that I have a physical address so that they can send attorney's fees payments to us at a right. physical address. That's the only reason I have an office, because I never, like I said, I never see anybody there. And my lawyers are always practicing at home anyway. So,
but I will say the office that you have is in a very, very nice location there.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really lovely.
I've been there since 2003 when I opened my first law firm. It's a great space, you know, both in terms of, you know, office space and conference room space. And also it's in the Reagan building. So there's a lot of exhibition space. So I have put on, you know, seminars and other things in there in that space over the years. So it's a great space. And it's, you know, three blocks from the White House, and you can't beat that.
I'm curious to ask, and again, like I said, we don't really get too much into substantive aspects of law on this show, but I am curious to know whether or not some of these big initiatives that have been taking place, the Infrastructure Act and the Recovery Act from the pandemic, does that put an extra burden on the labor market? Is that part of the rationale for the expanding growth that you're seeing?
Well, you know, I represent exclusively federal government employees, so I don't represent private sector employees.
Right.
And the reason I do that is because, you know, for the time being anyway, well, you know, since 1978 or before then, actually, you know, federal government employees are not at will like private sector employees. Private sector employees, for the most part, unless they're covered by a union contract, are terminatable at will, which works both ways. We can quit whenever we want.
Yeah.
We can be fired whenever we want or whenever our employer wants.
Right.
Federal employees, on the other hand, for the most part, are protected by due process rights. They have a constitutionally recognized interest under the Fifth Amendment, a property interest in their continued federal employment, as long as they're not a probationary employee. So a non-probationary federal employee, if the government wants to fire them, has to provide them due process, meaning written notice, 30 days advance written notice, all of the evidence that is relied upon to propose the action, an opportunity to respond orally and in writing to the proposal, and then appeal rights to the U.S. Merit System Protection Board, which is the successor to the old Civil Service Commission, which adjudicates, you know, these appeals of what we call adverse action, which are 15-day suspensions or worse, demotions in grade, or removals. And so federal employees have all of those protections. And the reason for that all stems back in the mid-1800s when we used to use the spoils system, when federal employment was really conditioned on pleasing the president politically.
Yeah.
And there's a movement to try to return to that I'm fighting daily. The person pushing that's name will remain nameless, but you know who I'm talking about.
I certainly do.
So, and because of the spoils system, you know, you only get a job or you only keep a job if you do what I tell you as the president, you know, including violating laws or including, you know, doing what, you know, whatever it is that I tell you to do. If you don't do it, if you don't please me, you're fired. And so for hundreds of years, that was the employment system for the federal government. One day, a disgruntled spoils system federal employee assassinated President Garfield.
Garfield, right.
Which led to the Pendleton Act, which was the first Civil Service Act, 1889, I believe, to provide that federal employment is no longer governed by the spoils system. It's governed by the civil service system, which means people have to test and are hired based on merit, knowledge, skills, and abilities, and they can't be fired for political reasons or non-meritorious reasons, you know, including what we call the prohibited personnel practices, which are set forth in 5 U.S.C. 2302B, 1 through 15, I believe, and, you know, EEO discrimination, political partisanship, marital status. These whistleblower retaliation or complaint or grievance retaliation are considered prohibited personnel practices. Federal employees cannot be terminated for any of those reasons. And that has stood from 1889 to 2023. There was a period under the last administration where that administration would prefer to eliminate those protections, eliminate the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978.
Right.
And return federal employment to an at-will, spoil system. luckily we ordered that plan. But you know, Trump is running again, and you know, I don't want to get political necessarily, but he, you know, if he gets reelected, he's going to dismantle the civil service.
That's been a stated goal for sure.
He wants to drain the swamp, as we say, openly
advocated for.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so
he wants to drain the swamp, and so I guess that makes me a swamp monster.
Yeah, it's a pretty good place to be, I think. I love the Washington, D.C. area. So listen, John, it's been terrific having an opportunity to get to know you and to understand your practice area a little better. Tell our audience, what's a good way that they can reach out to you if they want to follow up on anything you had to say?
Best place to reach us is on our website, which is www.attorneymahoney.com. So attorneymahoney, all one word, no dots or underscores.com. So www.attorneymahoney.com. Or they can call us directly at our main office, 202-350-3881.
Okay, well, we'll have all of that in our show notes for our audience. And I want to thank you again for the time you spent with us today. And next time I'm downtown, maybe we can arrange to have that cup of coffee or adult beverage.
Fantastic. I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, John, for being on The Law Entrepreneur. Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.